City of Camas.
Jeff Sarva, City of the City.
Tracy Coleman, City of Woodland.
Cherry Ferocher, City of Abingdon.
Ron Onslow, Mayor of Bridgefield.
Frank Hass, Bridgefield.
Janet Snook, Clark County.
I'm Mike Nerland, the Assistant Superintendent for Teaching and Learning at ESD 112.
Sam Crumlett, City of Abingdon Community Development Department.
I'm Ron Orlando, and I'm supporting the ACALT.
Alita, so it's Alita's first meeting, who else's first meeting? Welcome. Okay, can I get a motion to approve the minutes of January 8th, 2018?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
And we are going to add an agenda item here under number 3, I think.
There should be another 3.
Yeah. So it goes from 2 to 4. So 3 should be some information only on the spend down requirements.
So last meeting, I mentioned that, you know, we have some spend down timeliness requirements to meet with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and we were going to keep you updated on that. So Samantha has an update. This is where we stand right now.
Yeah, so as of February 7th, we need to spend $499,566 in CDBG funds before May 2nd. I'm projecting that Proud Ground will spend $85,000. The Hispanic Chamber of Commerce is on track to spend an additional $12,000. Bridgeview Community Center is an older project that is underway, and they'll spend out in the next 2 months. That's $90,000. And then we have our homeowner rehab program that is regularly spent on CDBG funds, but we're figuring about $75,000 will be expended through them. So that's a total of $262,000. So we need about $200,000, and we'll be looking for ways to do that. Of course, staff time will help spend down some of that. The county indirects can help spend down some of that, but we're kind of scrambling right now to make that timeliness test by May 2nd.
And as you, if you recall, part of this, or a big part of this, was created because of the delay in release of funds by HUD. 2017, usually we have a release of funds by August. We didn't receive a release of funds until November, so most of you working on projects, new projects, were not able to invoice us until December when you'd be able to start earlier. So, you know, we are working on that, and we will continue to keep you updated. I did approve for Proud Ground under the UCP guidelines for contingency funds. I approved $15,000 additional dollars of contingency funds, you know, which I'm allowed to do as per guidelines. I'm just making sure you're informed about this, which would help them get another home, you know, another homeowner with a house and help us, you know, continue with the spend down. So. And that's all I can think of right now, Sam. Can you think of anything?
The only other thing I would say is that jurisdictions across the country are complaining strongly about this right now, and HUD has already said, I'm sorry, you got your allocations late, but there's nothing we're going to do about that.
Yep.
You just don't need the test.
So what actions are we taking then? I know you're, what are we actually doing to try to get the other 2,000 allocated and spent?
Yeah, we're just, it's all been allocated, so we're just working with our partners to find any way that they can speed up either their construction
or
their buildings.
And what we can do is limited, you know, by people, you know, by projects' ability to invoice us. And as Sam said, it's all been allocated.
Right.
It just needs to be spent down. If we do not make the deadline, this is the first time we won't have made the deadline. Probably wouldn't be the only ones that does not make it okay, and we still, I'm hoping that we'll actually make it despite the time constraints. But if we do not make the deadline, what changes for us is we need to increase our reporting on spend down to HUD over the next year. If for some reason we didn't make the deadline 2 years in a row, then HUD will start considering whether to do any impacts to our funding, you know, if they reduce it or not. I do not know what the likelihood of that would be, honestly, because, you know, we are one of many, many jurisdictions that all have the same issue. I also, you know, we don't want to do it regardless, because honestly, the increase in requirements for reporting are a pain. There are significant administrative burden. Our normal reporting requirements are significant administrative burden, and the increase would just be absurd. But I'm also, I just want to say, I'm not too confident about what, you know, I have no idea what to expect in terms of our funding timelines this year either, because I don't really have any confidence that any of the issues, any of the political issues that led to delays in funding last year will not repeat themselves this year. So, you know, that's just FYI.
All right, thank you. Okay, we'll move on to CBG and home presentations.
And if you look at the reverse side, you have the scheduler. Go ahead.
Late Friday afternoon, Consumer Westar Born sent us an email saying that they were going to withdraw their application, and also they were going to rescind the money that was awarded in 2017. And this is because their organization decided and realized a little late that they did not want to take on the CDBG funds as a loan. So as a reminder for organizations that did not sign a three-year agreement, we award the CDBG funding as half grant, half loan, with 0% interest. We paid over 15 to 20 years, and that they did not want to do that. So they gave back their 2017 funds, and they took back their 2018 application, so they're not here this morning.
I have a question. So they're coming to do the presentation, correct? And are we allowed to ask questions and things like that? They get 5 minutes for the presentation.
We get 5 minutes for questions and presentation.
Okay. Thank you.
We typically give them 5 minutes to present and 5 minutes for you to ask questions following their presentation. So yes.
All right, well, good morning. My name is Mike Gerlins, and I'm the Assistant Superintendent for Teaching and Learning at ES Educational Service District 112. And I just want to thank you on behalf of our agency for allowing us to present this morning about our proposal for funding a couple of classrooms for our Early Childhood Education Assistance Program, or ECAP. So ESC 112, our mission is to equalize opportunities for all learning communities. And one of the ways that we do that is through our early childhood programming. We have over 300 families enrolled in our ECAP program throughout Clark County, or throughout the ESC 112 region, as well as we just recently received an early Head Start grant where we're serving 81 families. And so the importance of a high-quality early learning experience for children is just critical for their future goals, their future education, their future attainment. In our state, about 80% of all kindergartners enter kindergarten not ready. And the research shows that once students enter kindergarten and they're significantly behind, the chances of catching up are rare to slim. As you can see, that this is most impactful for low-income children. Estimates right now for a birth-to-five preschool program are in the range of a four-year university cost. It's just rocketing out of control. And the state has continued, actually expanded funding for the ECAP program, providing more slots. And we have expanded our program. They provided funding for the program itself. Unfortunately, they don't provide any capital funding. And so we have to depend upon, work with our partners to be able to provide the programs and services with creative ways of finding classroom space. You can see some of the data here. As I mentioned, starting behind nearly ensures that students will stay behind. As they go through the K-12 system, those students that aren't prepared and ready, districts have to spend a great amount of money per student just to get them through. If you take a look at data nationally, the juvenile justice system, over 80% are actually functionally illiterate. And that all begins in that birth to five time. So the children and families that we serve through our ECAP program, it's the most vulnerable population. 90% are below the poverty line. You can see the amount that are involved in the child welfare program, DSHS, mental health. Over 10% are actually even homeless. So the benefits of early learning, the benefits of this ECAP program benefit the entire community, benefit the entire county. Students that are part of ECAP enter kindergarten healthier. They're ready to learn. They're more likely to graduate from high school and go on to post-high school education. It's amazing the statistics of the number of students that aren't prepared, that don't complete high school. And in fact, Texas, they predict the number of beds they're going to need in their prison system by the students that aren't reading at grade level at the end of third grade. Here's the data from last year's statewide assessment data. This it's called the TS Gold Assessment, covers these areas. You can see the growth that the students made over the course of a year being enrolled in ECAP. So our ask would be to provide a double-wide modular. It would be on the Captain Strong campus in Battleground, and it would provide two classrooms. And the impact can be life-changing. You can see the number of hours provided for preschool, but not only working with kids, we also work with families. Provide three home visits. We provide them access and information about community resources, and a great deal more. And the impact is huge. The return on investment, as you can see, that's this $400,000, this investment would create our ability to provide $400,000 in services over a span of time. And you can see the amount, the number of families that would be impacted. We estimate that the classroom, the modular, would have a lifespan of 25 years. We can put 20 students in each classroom. So the impact is just incredible. In fact, the best way, and this is through research, to stop intergenerational poverty is through a strong preschool program. We're supported by Battleground, our partner, Mark Ross, and he probably is aging a little bit because they have a bond coming up tomorrow. I know that's a big thing. But I'm confident that is going to pass. But I just want to thank you for allowing us to present. We feel, we've got a quality program. We can provide the services. We just need a space to provide those services. So, any questions you might have?
So you're expecting, you have 300 kids involved, mm-hmm. families and kids involved. How many more would you be able to help with?
This would be another 40 each year. So we have 20 in each classroom.
And you're not in Battleground now?
We do have we do have one classroom there and very old portables there on the Captain Strong campus. The lifespan of those portables has been over 25 years actually.
So you're saying you have one now and you're going to add two, or you're going to replace the one?
We hope to add two.
So you have
we've been allowed some space in Captain Strong itself. The portables that we were in are now spaces for K-12. I think the second or third grader out there right now. Yeah?
How many kids are you currently serving about then?
We serve about 20 kids right now.
And so you'd be serving about 60?
Mm-hmm.
What other school districts do you offer this program in?
Vancouver, Evergreen, Richfield, Kalama, Washougal.
So is it safe to assume that by opening additional space in Battleground, that would help free up capacity in other districts as well?
Possibly, yes. It's not like a neighborhood school. If there's openings and we'll say a family from Richfield would like to enroll their child in ECAP and they qualify, they can certainly do that. Yes.
So what you're asking for, you're asking for $300,000,
mm-hmm.
correct? And the $300,000 would provide you one or two modulars.
We provide one modular, two classrooms.
Two classrooms.
Yeah.
And then it would accommodate 40 kids in each class?
20 in each.
20 in each class for a total of 40 kids.
Mm-hmm.
What's your need beyond that? Do you have additional need and you're only going for $300,000, or would that satisfy the needs in Battleground this time?
You know, certainly there is a need to expand the ECAP, actually in countywide. But we feel like this would serve a short-term need. As the Battleground, just like all of Clark County, continues to grow, there's going to be additional needs.
Okay.
Yes?
What happens to the children in Battleground right now that want to join the program? Is there no space for them?
Yeah. We have a waiting list in all of our ECAP programs. And so as kids age out, then we can bring in new kids. ECAP is for 3 to 5 year olds, and our early Head Start program is birth to two.
Did you say you did home visits as well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so part of the program is 3
home visits per year, more if needed. And we try to, there's several things that take place during a home visit. Certainly answering questions that the families have, provide them with access to mental and mental health and a doctor, dentist, if they're needed. Make them aware of the resources that are available in the community. So, in fact, there's been recently a couple articles in the Columbian about two single moms that, through the support that we provide for families, they actually got jobs, were able to establish their own budgets, and it's had an impact.
Sorry, just some clarification. So they don't have to live in the Battleground School District, just in the ESD district?
Yeah, they don't have
so
to live
benefit
in.
The whole community.
It benefits the whole county. You know, just the long-term impacts on any kid that is involved in an early learning program impacts all of us. And these programs, like I say, they impact the most vulnerable residents that we have here in Clark County.
And you have funding for the program, you just need the facility.
Right, yep.
And I'm only going to add that I'm part of the school's advisory council. We have county director now, and that meets quarterly, and it's most of the superintendents in Clark County are on that school's advisory board. And this topic came up last week during that meeting, and the impact and importance of kids being ready for school. And when they're not, they end up in our jails, they end up, you know, this whole ACEs type scenario where they've got adverse childhood experiences, and those things just add to cost as we try to deal with these kids as they go through the system. So it's a pretty significant topic in our community and around the country.
I have a question. Is there a family community resource center up in the Battleground area?
We have family community resource centers in several schools throughout Clark County. Battleground does have a community resource center within, I don't know which school, but within their district, and we help support that as well.
They're at the Casey Center.
Pardon me?
They're at the Casey Center.
Oh, okay, yeah. It's, you know, just the ability for families, especially at this young age, feeling comfortable to come into a school district, have those resources, get to know staff, not only, you know, early learning staff, but that transition into K-12 as well. I also just have a letter of support from Mark Ross that I'm happy to leave with you if you'd like to look at that, as well as just kind of a final summary of what we went through. So,
thank you.
Anyway, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for all the work you do and the service you provide. So, it's going to be a beautiful day here in Clark County.
Yeah. And next we have, are you ready? I know we're a little bit early. This is for Vancouver Chamber.
Actually, you really want to wait for Jeanette to show up.
Oh, okay.
I'd be happy to accompany her, but she'll be making the presentation. It's going to change. Sam is updating it because of the CBET.
Oh. Right.
So.
Chamber of Commerce, and this is John McDonough.
Like most of us, I'm
Yeah. Real quick overview of Greater Vancouver Chamber of Commerce. We're 128 years old so far, and the Chamber has invested in many programs, such as the Procurement Technical Assistance Program, which is PTAC, the Workforce and Small Business Assistance Program as well. So it's very important that the Chamber not only serve our members, but also the community. Now, so the program that we're proposing is Business Path to Success. And the program is a 10-week program. And it's going to be guided to low, mid-income entrepreneurs in Clark County. The format is going to be classroom and online format. And we're utilizing a Kauffman Foundation curriculum. And also with that program, we're going to be using expert speakers. We're going to, of course, still be mentoring, one-on-one guidance. And then once the program is completed from beginning to end, at the end, we'll be able to review the participants' business plan, their financial forecast, and their, so it is from beginning to end. So the idea is for them to have an idea, and then by 10 weeks have an end product of this, such as a business plan. So what is it basically going to be providing? So they're going to discover their target market, which is very key, and identifying their advantages. They're going to create a well-researched business plan. They're going to develop a realistic financial plan. They're going to define their company's brand and marketing, and then determine their steps for profitability. And they're also going to identify funding sources if they qualify. Okay. Of course, they're going to learn to manage their business functions during that process. Now, the Greater Vancouver Chamber of Commerce is going to be partnering up with the Kauffman Foundation. If you don't know who they are, they are also devoted to entrepreneurship. They focus on research, education, technical assistance, and policy increase the number of success rates in individuals and process in starting growing their own business idea. Now, the Fast Track program that we're going to be using was developed by hundreds of successful entrepreneurs who share their knowledge, insights, and stories. It's actually, the program's been around since the 1980s. The design program was based on proven principles, techniques, and leadership tactics, and makes basically to start a successful business. So that is a quick overview on that program. And do you have anything to add?
Just a couple of comments this morning. We have had a small business assistance program funded by the City of Vancouver for 4 years now.
2015, yes.
And serve by contract with them 30 small business entrepreneurs in the moderate to low income range, but are restricted to serve only people whose business or residence is in the City of Vancouver. So I know I've visited with a couple of you over the years about wanting to bring that to the entire county and provide that resource. We turn away over twice as many businesses as we serve in the City of Vancouver because of the residency and business location factor. So we know that there's a high need and are just hopeful that you see the value in serving that need throughout the county. We recognize that there are social service needs in the county that could use 10 times the funds that you all are charged with distributing, but we think in the economic development side, we actually can help people move away from falling into that social service safety net and actually be contributing business owners and taxpayers.
Yeah,
of course.
So how do you recruit people to join this or to take the course?
where do you find?
Actually, I get calls at least 5 times a day on people that are interested in starting a program, you know, a business, I'm sorry. And I ask all the time, where do you hear us? They Google, they hear it from one of our community partners. We've been doing this small business assistance program since 2015, and so now it's really like, oh, I heard you guys, you know, have a program that helps businesses. So the word is out there that we do that for the community. Unfortunately, not everyone qualifies, and that's one of the questions I have to ask them is, so what's your address? Do you live in Vancouver? And they're like, oh, yes, I do. But unfortunately, sometimes they don't fall within the city jurisdiction. And I triage them as much as I could in that phone call and try to collect as much information. But eventually, I can't help them more than just that conversation. And I do refer them to community partners, but a lot of our community partners don't serve that initial startup group.
Yeah. Do you track the success of the businesses that have been in your
any of the previous programs? Of course. So the city, obviously, we do monthly and quarterly reports and provide success stories with them. So and that's how I plan to do this program, is to give monthly reports and quarterly reports and success stories through that whole process.
So if I could address that as well. So we have a percentage of those entrepreneurs who come to us that actually either expand or launch their business. We also are successful in keeping people from taking a bad step forward because they're not prepared. And so Jeanette has counseled a number of folks to go back to the drawing board and really think about what they're doing. The nice thing about the Kauffman is it's a tested curriculum that marches them through that process, and at the end they know exactly what they need to do.
What's your current funding from the city of Vancouver? How big is that program?
It's only a part-time, 20 hours a week of my time, and as far as the amount.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how many people you serve.
According to that program, 30.
Mm-hmm. And then is it the same curriculum, or is it different program?
This is a new format of program. This one that I'm...
Which we are introducing to our city clients as well.
And then I think maybe to your question, is there the population that you serve? Is it low income? Are there certain criteria that would qualify them to get into the program?
For this program?
Yeah.
It would make you low, according to HUD.
Yep. How do you determine mid to low?
There is a chart that is... that I go by from HUD income, and it's just, that's what
I want to say it's 80% of the...
80% of HUD.
Or less of the average income in the area.
So if I don't make anything and I want to be an entrepreneur, I have a really low income, right? Is that how you determine that?
Say that one more time.
If I don't work, if I don't have a job.
Well, you'd be surprised how many entrepreneurs don't have income that you think they do. Most people that do have that income or the extra income to start the business, which is great. I mean, there are resources. They're more likely to get funded. They most likely have access to funding. It's this group of people that just don't. They need credit repair. Sometimes they have great credit, but just because they don't have that extra money on their household, they don't have anything set aside to start a business, nobody's going to fund them.
Okay, now the other question is, do you also help existing businesses?
Correct.
But there's a different parameter that you look at?
No, they're still not making that. It means that they're not making the money they should be making, because, I mean, their business can be making a certain amount, maybe cut, you know, breaking even, but that doesn't mean most owners are not taking anything home.
I could maybe an example of someone that we have served in the city program. one of our clients had a art instruction studio, got into a really bad lease, did not have a business plan, worked with Jeanette for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to help her find legal counsel to address the lease issue, and she has now emerged as a very successful small business out of Vancouver Mall and is thriving.
So if I'm a resident outside of Vancouver city limits but would otherwise be eligible, and I come to you, and you cannot serve me because I'm a county resident, would you refer me to the Hispanic Chamber program?
I have done, because they, I know that they have other funding besides the city. So I have done that, but there's nothing that I can follow through. And I also provide them SBDC and Buck, but I know he's extremely packed and busy. And so so I refer him. These are your options.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but
just a clarification, you said 80% and below?
Yes.
Of AMI.
Yes.
How many people are you going to be able to run through this program with the $70,000 you're asking for?
The idea is to serve, I believe in the contract we said 60. 60? 60.
60 people through the program. And so it's a 10-week program, and it's for low to moderate income. Most of them don't have education, I'm assuming.
No,
correct?
They do.
They do have education,
they
but they're still low to moderate income, so they have degrees.
Okay.
Yes. And so, because one of my concerns is you're running them through a 10-week program, and there's no way that somebody's going to get the skill set that they need to manage a business in 10 weeks if they don't have some other type of education. And so, if you're running, you know, 60 people through this program, and you said there's a success rate, but what is the success rate? You didn't really answer that question. Is it out of the businesses that start up, is it 50% of them are successful? Is it 20%? Is it 80%? What
the,
is it?
For me, a success rate is, for example, if they go through this process and during that process they say, you know what, I'm really not ready to start. This is not a good time. To me, that's a success rate because I don't want them to be spending money or time on something that they don't have and they're not ready for. That's one. The other group is that they learn for example, I do have existing clients that are coming in that have been in business several years, and they're still learning the fundamentals because they didn't go through that process initially. So this is going through the fundamentals of you know, just basic business concepts. So I think that's a success if they're learning something new that they can integrate into their business model, current existing businesses. And then another part of success rate is that from beginning to end, a client can have a plan. A business plan may change within their first year of business. I mean, that's just, it happens. But at least they have a plan and they have something that they can move forward from saying, you know what, we might not launch, but we have a plan that what we're gonna do. And this is, it might be like, okay, well, we need to establish our credit or we need to look for locations. But they know exactly how much they need. They know if they're going to go to a bank, to a funder, they know exactly how much they're asking for. Most people don't come in that door knowing exactly what they want or what they need.
I think it's important, too. The clients that we've served in the city are not currently on unemployment. They're not coming out of shelters. You know, these are people who have been working. They've, tried to start something in the garage or on the dining room table, and they want to take the next step, but they have never had the business training in terms of how to go down that path. Those are the folks that we're trying to work with. I can't say that we haven't seen the others, but by and large, those aren't our people that we wind up bringing into the program.
So we're past the well past the 5 minutes of questions, but are there any other questions? I haven't stopped it because, you know, Hispanic Chamber, our next presenter, is not here yet.
They're in the...
Oh, are they? Oh, in that case, I should have stopped it. I'm sorry. All right. Thank you.
Thank you all for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Not good, bad, no.
No, they were...
All right. have 5 minutes to present. We'll have 5 minutes of questions when you're 1 minute out. Just, are you ready?
Yeah. Good morning. My name is Diana Nunez. I'm the president of the Hispanic Metropolitan Chamber. Thank you, commissioners, for having us here today. We're going to present on our small business technical assistance application that we have entered with the Clark County. A little bit about us. We were founded in 1994. The Hispanic Metropolitan Chamber has been a partner with and an advocate for the Latino community and businesses for over 20 years. In 2017, the Hispanic Chamber engaged in a strategic planning process to consider its relevance, its impact, and its future direction. The insights gained through this process have informed our vision, mission, and goals. So we have a new vision, which is for Latinos to prosper and contribute as business owners and industry leaders in an inclusive economy. Our mission is to advance Latino economic and community vitality through business development, leadership, education, and advocacy. And this, we have four goals that influence our work on a day-to-day basis. They are to assist Latino businesses to start, grow, adapt, and succeed. We cultivate Latino career and leadership advancement to influence inclusive and sustainable community and economic development. And we advocate for policies and programs that contribute to Latino economic development and inclusive and sustainable economic development. And lastly, we aim to operate as an effective and resilient organization.
Commissioners, my name is Hector Miramontes. I serve as the VP of Business and Economic Development at the Chamber. The way that we accomplish this work is we really count on a team of business development coordinators to contribute to the shared economic development goals of the county is trying to advance. So we really work to deliver these services to Clark County residents. Currently at the Bank of America building just downtown by the theater, for the last 3 years we've been delivering those services to Clark County residents mostly at that office. So we have a couple of years of experience in doing that. Our approach is really to be a partner in the development of these community members who are trying to launch, manage, and evolve successful businesses. We really think that this has a lot of potential to help with poverty abatement, but also just stronger economic development overall. We have 3 years that we've had a staffed office downtown, like I said, the Bank of America building. And for the last 6 months, we've had Cardinals staffing the downtown office. I'd love to maybe share a little story about that.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Carlos Moreno. I'm one of the business advisors and work here at the downtown location. Been with the Chamber for about 5 years and at this location for the last 6 months. We primarily work one-on-one with small business owners to help them not only understand what are the rules of starting a business, how to apply for licensing, permitting, or registration, make sure that they're in full compliance, but our goal is to really allow them to showcase and bring the positive products and services they can offer to the overall community. One of the small businesses that we work with out of Woodland, Oregon is Revolution Janitorial Services. They are a mother and daughter duo which started doing housekeeping a couple years ago. They came in through our doors, we helped them understand licensing, permission, and then we now help them grow. They were recently awarded a contract with the VA hospital after the full construction remodel that they went through. And they're looking to partner with other public agencies for other procurement opportunities. And that's something that we're very proud of trying to help them brokerage. That is just one example of a small business that went from just doing light jobs to really being able to focus on their business and able to impact their household budget significantly. We work with all residents of the community, so though our focus is Latinos, this contract is for us to serve over 100 small businesses, 32 of which will be selected for ongoing services. And again, this is for all community members throughout the Clark County. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, we'll be happy to answer them.
Yep.
Thank
you. We timed ourselves with four.
It did.
So we funded you guys last year.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So tell us about how that last year funding from us went and how that, you know, was put into.
So the contract was assigned to was initially it was going to start on July 1st for the new fiscal year. There was a couple of delays, it seemed like, so it didn't actually start until December 1st. So we've had a month and a half, well, two whole months now. But thankfully, we've had an office here in Vancouver for the last 3 years. So we have been serving Clark County. But now, thanks to this new partnership and funding, we're able to do it so in a much more deliberate and impactful manner. So we're looking to really leverage the connections that we've already established throughout the community.
The different cities are, we've seen businesses from Yakult, Woodland, Ridgefield, Camas,
Battleground. The center.
So
yes.
We're already seeing clients coming from there and outreaching as well. And we're leveraging businesses that we've already worked with to meet new entrepreneurs or people who might want to start a business in the community or city.
What's the percentages between Vancouver and the rest of the county?
So this new contract is specifically just to work in Clark County with the exception of Vancouver. So that will be, those 100 SaaS businesses and 32 of direct ongoing services will be everybody except Vancouver.
Okay, mm-hmm. And that sounds like a dumb question, but in your advisement,
mm-hmm.
you do or do not discourage people who have not got a decent plan?
Our goal is to help them evaluate the risk of starting a business. So at times, I will consider it a success for somebody to not register their business and invest if they don't feel ready to it. So our goal is to always help the individual realize and know how to move appropriately. And if at times that means that they're not ready, that's fine. It gives them a bit more time to really think it through.
I think something related to that is that we really think about how can we help our clients that we're serving grow wealth over time. So it's not that it's going to be an immediate thing, but it's more of a process and a journey for learning about what it takes to build and maintain wealth. And certainly business and entrepreneurship is one element of that. But our office also looks at ways to support that through other programs also that contribute to that asset wealth. So there's a number of things.
The 60,000 is for 100. Did you say we serve 100 new businesses?
So 100 businesses assessed, so we will work with 100 businesses to see where they are in the process and if they meet the needs of the CDBG contract. And then we will work specifically with 32 of those more in depth as far
okay.
as to grow.
And that's 100 new, not any existing.
Right.
Our goal is to track them for 3 years and help them see them. So we'll track not only revenue, but obviously we're looking at profit. And as we're talking about wealth creation, we're looking at their assets. So we're looking around to see their business and life in a holistic approach. And from our goal is finding those 32 out of those 100 assess of people who are dedicated, who will have some level, who are coachable and are willing to learn, because of course we're Hector mentioned this is a bit of a journey through and a learning strategy, but thankfully we beat the national standard of business retention.
But you have a, you've been doing this in Oregon as well as in Vancouver. Do you have any, like, for your standard of business retention, what is it and what's your experience so far?
For the last 14 years, we've served businesses over 3,200, I believe 3,200 businesses over the last 14 years in one way to grow, succeed, register. So it, depending on each contract that we work with, we track for about 3 years. And those are based on business registrations, asset to capital, staff growth, jobs created. So we do follow those and they depend on which contract and we track those metrics throughout those.
So you can track for about 3 years?
Right, it's usually about how we see, usually once, because they have to qualify as far as a certain income level, by about 3 years we tend to see them already rise above that, usually it's how we determine whether they stay on or they continue to survive.
And I can offer maybe a little excerpt that might be helpful to sort of think about one aspect of the outcomes that we're hoping to generate. I've been with the chamber for just shy of 3 months. I used to work for the city of Portland in the Office of Government Relations. And what I've seen just in the short time that I've been here is just sitting with some of our clients, I've seen one family that started of their own business 2.5 years ago. First year of operations, they generated $31,000 in income, which of course is still low income by federal standards, of course, but especially for their family size. In their second year of operations, they generated $92,000. You know, that we still need to work with them on making sure their pricing mechanisms are really supporting a healthy business. But just the level of income that they're generating is a lot, is growing. So we have stories like that I think sort of shed light on the ways that we are helping to generate income for low-income residents with a focus on low-income residents.
And just so you know, we're at the 10-minute mark. They finished a minute early, so we've had 6 minutes of questions. And I know that Vancouver Housing Authority is here right now. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful sunny day.
Yeah, it's cold outside. Thank you.
Oh, but Salvation Army?
Yes.
It passed. It passed.
That's right.
They said to just give you their funding, is that what they said?
Yeah.
I said, no thanks.
And 5 minutes presentation, 5 minutes questions. When you're at the 4 minute mark, I'll just wave the sign at you.
Okay.
Kristen?
Sure.
Roy, we'll make sure you only have 3 minutes.
So I have some handouts. May I start them here?
Sure. Thank you.
Kind of illustrate what we're talking about.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Steve Rusk, and I have the privilege of being the development director for the local Salvation Army. With me is Megan Dixon with Westby Associates. For those of you who have had a chance to read the application, it's no surprise that we are in a capital fundraising project, and that's why we're here this morning to ask for the county's support in helping us close the gap. We're 84% funded to a $5.6 million goal of building a community resource center that will serve all of Clark County. So, for those of you who wonder what the Salvation Army does, in a nutshell, I'll tell you that we are in the business of helping the hungry, the homeless, the hurting, the jobless, the lonely, the lost, just about everybody who doesn't have somewhere else to go, or falls between the cracks, we're there. Name familiarity goes a long ways. We find that over the years, many people come to us just because of that. They've heard the Salvation Army is a place to turn to. We take that as an honor, a privilege, and a responsibility. A responsibility to the community to be up on resources in the community, not only to know our business and how we can best help them directly, but there are requests from A to Z, from birth to burial, that come to us, and it's our privilege and responsibility to provide for them knowledge of other resources when we can't help directly.
So the need for expansion and consolidation. So right now in Vancouver, the Salvation Army is located at 2 different sites, and they're each 8 miles apart, which doesn't seem like a very long distance unless you don't have money for gas or unless you don't have transportation to get to that other site 8 miles away. So we have 2 different locations serving the east side of Vancouver, which we know is growing in both size but also in need. We did a needs assessment in 2015, and it showed a substantial increase in kiddos who need free or reduced lunches, an increase in the homeless population over on the east side, and just a general increase in those who are not making a living wage and able to support their families. Right now, the SAY Club, which is the after-school program for at-risk youth coming from the local elementaries,
think of it as a boys or girls club, but for those that don't have access to a boys or girls club, they come to the Salvation Army site. There is a wait list for kiddos to get into that program just because we don't have the space or the capacity to increase the number served. And we're serving a more diverse population, those who come to the food pantry and receive a food box. Maybe they have cultural preferences or maybe they have food preferences and they're not able to utilize all that's in that actual food box. So serving a more diverse population. And we have a lot of adults and parents in need of training. They need to be trained on how on the job preparedness, resume writing, but even some of the basics, like, you know, if you get a food box from a food pantry, how do you use those dried beans? How do you use those items in there? So we have a vision for this consolidated community resource center that meets a lot of these needs.
And let me say, first of all, in talking about our vision, the Salvation Army provides services from three locations in Clark County currently. We have our administration and youth program services on 112th Avenue. We have our Family Services Center, which is the majority of our frontline work is done daily, providing housing, clothing, food assistance on 47th Avenue. And then in Camas, Washougal, we've just completed an expansion project there.
So this is our vision for the future, is that 8,600 square foot community resource center adjacent to the 112th current center that we have. So it'll be all on one property. The property is owned by the Salvation Army. You see here, this is the current building, right, Steve? And then this would be the new building. I know we're running out of time, so I want to make sure we get to the place we need to go. So we will double and enhance the Safe Club program, have a shopping-style food pantry, a children's play area so they can play while parents are getting food or meeting with case managers, more increased case manager privacy, a clothing closet, a teaching kitchen. It's $5.6 million for the project, and we're almost there. We're at 84% of the way funded. So I want to make sure we get to this one right here. So with CPBG support, we are asking the county for $178,300. The city for $250,000. And then if funded with those two CDBG sources, we'd be at 92% of the way to goal. And we have strategies in place right now, including a grant to the N.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust to help fill that gap, with the goal then to break ground in the fall.
And I think it's important to note that during the application process, we did obtain a permission from our headquarters to pay back half of the loan. We build very conservatively as a debt-free organization, so getting them to agree to paying back was not a small thing. So they do see the value of using public dollars for this project and have agreed to the terms outlined. Thank you.
5 minutes goes quickly.
Thank
you.
So I have concern about the location. It's not very accessible by public transit. How are people going to get there when you add a bigger facility?
Yeah. So we used to have a C-Tran bus stop in front of our offices on 112th, and we are currently in process of working with C-Tran, the city and the county. In fact, I just spoke to Councillor Bolt, who's working with us on this.
The bus goes by, but doesn't stop. Is that what it's
correct?
No, it goes down there at 12:20.
We would love to work with C-Tran and the city to have a pull off in front of our place there on 112.
How many additional kids or families do you anticipate to be able to serve in the community facility?
So with our expansion, we will be able to double our capacity because the expansion includes a remodel of our current facility, which turns office space into classroom space. So we'll go from 30 to 60 kids.
Mm-hmm. So it's closing one. If you build this, you close another.
We closed the leased facility that we have on 47th Avenue.
Right.
Yeah. savings of over $48,000 a year, which frees us up to put those dollars back in direct service.
Pretty clear. Good job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael, I have a quick question. What part is loan and what is?
Say it again.
What's grant and what is loan?
So generally speaking, when we do a CDBG approval of funding, about 50% is going to be grant, 50% will be a loan. The terms of the loan vary between 0% and 3%, and they generally match what it would be for home. And the payback period varies with the revenue that the organization will make out of that facility, and it can go out to about 50 years. So with them, it would be a half grant, half loan, 0% interest, and was it 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
On a 20-year term.
That's part of 178?
Yes.
So it's half?
Kind half of that.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, the revenue that is paid back to the county goes as program income directly back out to other programs, you know, in future allocation cycles.
And it's a similar arrangement with the Vancouver grant, if they get it.
I believe so. Each jurisdiction has some flexibility in terms of the terms of their grants and loans, but I'm pretty sure Vancouver is similar to ours.
Okay.
Especially in joint projects specifically, we try to match each other's terms.
So that's true for each one of these?
Yes.
In this category?
Yes. We have been having I think I mentioned it at the last meeting, maybe the last two meetings, we have been having increasing incidences of nonprofits being like, hey, how do we waive the payback requirement? Can we waive it? And in many cases, they're making those requests after you have approved their applicant, that you've approved their proposal, and sometimes even after they have signed the agreements. And what we want to be sure, even though we don't want to prohibit waivers, we do want to treat all applicants fairly. And so if the Salvation Army says, hey, we are going to accept these terms, I think that should be present in your mind when you're evaluating that proposal against another proposal that says we're asking for a waiver so we don't have to pay anything back. Like CBAP wanted to do before they withdrew their application. You could still select it, but be aware of the entirety of the proposal. So one thing we're talking about doing in future applications is having right in the proposal, be part of the proposal, we want to accept these terms, or we need a waiver from these terms, and have that weighted in terms of points separately as part of the application. Sam, you were going to say that.
So that being said, so the two Chamber of Commerce, because they're programs and not facilities, there would be no payback on the program funds. And also, we've determined internally that homeless shelters have no capacity to repay, and so
thank you. And that's an important clarification I did not make. So facilities, yes, loan. Programs, no. And then the only difference between facilities is the homeless shelter piece, because they don't generate any kind of community centers, you know, like what Salvation Army presented, they will do often fee-for-service programs in there. They will generate some revenue. And based on that pro forma of revenue generation is what we do with the loan terms. Any other questions before we go on to VHA?
How much total in CDBG social do we have to allocate this year?
Oh my gosh. CDBG social?
Well,
how much we have to, well,
yeah,
we don't really.
We have about $1.2 million we split between the two types, the two categories, so probably $550.
And we're ready for you when you are.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Roy Johnson with Vancouver Housing Authority, and I do have two applications that I submitted, and just a brief comment that is about both of them. All three facilities have been operated by the Housing Authority for about 26 years. So we're really coming into a period when major infrastructure improvements have been made that are necessary. Over the last couple of years, we have applied for CDBG from the city and the county. And so we have been able to make some improvements, but we still have a number that are outstanding. And the comments were made about the income of the lack of income for the shelters. We lease them to the service providers for about $1 a year and they don't pay it. So we really don't have any receipts that we're able to use. The Housing Authority contributes over $200,000 per year in working with the homeless population outside of our typical rent subsidy programs through support of SHARE for some of the operations. And for the maintenance, ongoing repairs during the year, and then also support for the current day shelter. So the Housing Authority already contributes quite a bit to it, and these were never set up with any kind of source for doing major improvements. So the first application is for Orchard Inn, and what our request is $150,000, and we made that similar request to the city, and so we will be presenting on those in the future. With the Inn at the Orchard, I believe that you probably got the project evaluation, the budget worksheet, but we do have some significant things that we need to prioritize. So depending on what kind of funding award, we would go back through and determine what we absolutely need to get done, and doing roofing and doing some plumbing work and flooring would be those priorities. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions on the inn, unless you want me to do them both together.
It's up to you.
Okay, let me go ahead and do that. So the other application is for Safe Choice and Valley Homestead. So Safe Choice is operated by YWCA and Valley Homestead, like the inn is by SHARE. One thing I didn't catch this until this morning when I was looking at the agenda, but the final application requests for both the city and the county were equal at 260. So I think this shows 2 and 350. So the initial pre-application was broken down a little bit different. And similar to what we were looking at with the other application, we do have significant repairs. The Valley Homestead is also looking at a need for roofing and heating systems and CO2 detectors as well as smoke detectors. And less so over at Safe Choice, just because of the fact that we have been able to make some good improvements over the last couple of years, which is very fortunate because it is the older of all the facilities. So there isn't a great amount that is being requested specifically for Safe Choice that are of urgent need as what they would be at the other two shelters. Although we do have a request for 157 and just hard repairs. But again, we would be able to prioritize and best use of whatever funds that might come our way from both the city and the county.
So this is not new shelter capacity, correct? This is maintenance and repair
exactly
of existing shelter.
Right.
Without looking at the numbers, I'm assuming that you submitted, what is the roofing cost for each of the facilities? Do you have bids on that?
We use, just from what we have historically from our bid jobs, and about $60,000.
$60,000 on each building?
Yes.
Okay, and then for the plumbing, what are we looking at for the plumbing on the orchards?
Okay, so the inn at the orchards we have, because we need to replace a very large gas water heaters, that's $45,000.
And the heating, is it an HVAC system, just a heat pump? Or?
We have those mini split systems in common areas, but not in the rooms themselves. Those are.
So you're looking to add a few to the rooms and
well, they might be replacement of the cadets, but still just heat in those rooms.
What does that cost?
Let's see. So for the heaters, $25,000 over at Valley Homestead, and then they also had the roof for $60,000. Detectors,
$20,000.
Thank you. Do any folks stay in the shelters you know about?
Our count that they provided.
We have about 3,000 unduplicated individuals stay in shelters throughout the county each year.
What's unduplicated?
Unduplicated means they're unique individuals. We're not counting them more than once. So they may stay at a shelter more than one time, but we're counting them once. I mean, if we, we're just counting them once, so we're not, providing you triple counted numbers of who's benefiting from the.
So folks come and they stay for some period of time and they get assistance and hopefully get on their
hopefully
feet or whatever. That's what these buildings do.
Yes.
Right, and I'm sorry, I shouldn't have assumed that you are real familiar with them, but both Valley and Orchards are family shelters, and then Safe Choice is domestic violence shelter. They have been extending their time that people can stay at the shelters right now just because there's no handoff transitional type of ability right now, so. That probably has reduced the overall number that they did in last year, but served a pretty important need. You may have been hearing in the news in Portland, they had a family shelter that they shut down because the roof was falling in, and they're scrambling for where to place the families. And that's going to long-term, or it could be, several months that they're having to find alternate because of failure to take care of them.
And these are grants, not loans.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions for Roy?
How many are you currently housing at the Safe Choice in the Valley shelter? You said that's a domestic shelter, violent shelter.
Safe Choice.
Yeah. Just approximately.
Oh boy. I think they have right around 20
beds. So VHA is not the operator, they just maintain the facility, so if you're seeing him scramble a little bit on the numbers of those served, that's the reason why.
I just didn't know enough about it.
Sure.
I knew that I saw the roof, so that's one of the reasons why I had that question.
Mm-hmm.
So I do have a question. Since I'm unfamiliar with the whole process, do we ever offer less than what they ask for?
Yes.
So if we see things like $52,000 to replace bedroom wardrobes and things like that. Can we just pick what we think was?
So not like by budgetary line item, but there are plenty of cases where someone a proposal requests $200,000, and you rank them. Generally speaking, when you rank them, they get funded in their entirety in order of priority until you run out of money, and then as if there are $100,000 left and the last proposal was asking for $150,000, we go back and ask that entity is proposing, can you work it with $100,000? And they give us the answer. You do have the power to choose to fund it differently than it's being requested. But in that case, you would just do an amount. You wouldn't be like, yes, but we're subtracting, these line items. Were you going to say something, Sam?
We would prioritize. We know what's more of those health and safety type of things as opposed to, it's just beat up equipment. There's probably been occasions that you gave more than what was asked for, too, right?
Yes, probably. But not while I've been here.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And since he was doing two presentations at once, we're still within our timeline, but I did let him go over.
Back on track.
Yeah. Thank you, Roy.
Thank you.
Okay. So we
are on break till 10.
And I am not going to be here for the second half of the meeting, so I think they're going to be here. So, Michael.
Cool. And we'll forward you the presentations.
You have a meeting?
We changed council time for a little while, experiment to Monday mornings instead of Wednesday afternoon. So this is the second thing we've done.
Fund something, and how much each entity funds is based on the population that's being served. So, for example, if hypothetically Salvation Army did a facility in the city of Vancouver and applied to funding to the county, that would have to be a joint proposal with the city, and we would fund it based on what percentage of the population to be served comes from the county that are not city residents. So if that facility were to serve 53% of individuals in the county, we would fund up to 53% of the total requested from the city and the county. That's for policy. That's policy that's been reviewed and approved by both you and the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And we have been asked in the past by HUD, how do we under what circumstances we allow projects that are outside of our jurisdiction, of our area of service, and how do we determine how much funding goes into it. When it comes to shelters, the city of Vancouver has recently notified us that they do not want to do proportional funding, that they want to do straight 50-50 funding, 50%, 50%. That's not been a huge issue near term, because other than orchards, we don't really have shelters outside of the city limits. So it's very clear that the county as a whole benefits, to the existing shelters in the system. But as that moves forward, and let's say Washougal, Ridgefield, Battleground, any shelters that get established there, I think it's not realistic that the city of Vancouver is going to approve 50% of that funding. So that's one thing that will be a future item discussion in the UCPV of how you want to, how do you want to do that? Do you want shelters not to be eligible to be joint projects, and so if it's in the city limits, if they only apply to the city? Or if it's within the city limits, you want to go ahead and do 50-50 funding, which is what the city is requesting, and understanding that we will do 100% of the funding for proposals that happen outside of the city limits. But that's, future item discussion. But just, I'm mentioning it now so that you're ready for it, and you know it's coming down the line. And since Roy Johnson just presented on those shelters, that was an item of discussion with the city prior to his presentation that came up.
just trying to throw a monkey wrench into the works.
You don't have to worry about this application round, but I'm sure, you know, this is not going to be the last time we get requests for funding of either maintenance or construction of shelter facilities. You know, so it's something to be ready for. And next we have Community Services Northwest with Homeless Engagement Navigator. And you have a 5 minutes presentation, 5 minutes questions. When you're at 4 minutes in the presentation, I'll just and ready when you are.
All right. So I'm Amy Morrison. I'm from Community Services Northwest. For those who don't know, we're a nonprofit behavioral health agency. We provide mental health treatment, substance use disorder treatment, and housing and supportive services to low-income individuals in Clark County. So obviously we're here today to talk about housing, so we're going to focus on our housing department a little bit. Our housing department has been in operation and providing supportive services for the past 10 years. So as part of that experience, we are currently providing permanent supportive housing programs and rapid rehousing programs to over 50 unique households in Clark County. We also have a long-standing relationship with private landlords, so we're able to work with the folks in our programs to quickly get them into housing, despite barriers that they might have moving in. We also, in all of our housing programs, we follow the housing first principles, so that means that we are immediately getting individuals access to housing without any prerequisites. So they come into the housing program, and regardless of where they're at or what they're doing, we're working on them to get them housed right away. And then we're addressing the other issues that may be present. We also do consumer choice and self-determination. That means the individuals that we're working with get to decide where and when they want to move in and how they want their housing to look like, what location they're in, what supports they're close to, that kind of thing. We also do recovery-focused, so anything that the individual is working on, whether that be mental health, education, substance use disorders, we're focusing on recovery moving forward with the clients. Individualized and client-driven supports, that means every individual we're working with, their case is unique to that case manager. Regardless of, we've had worked with other folks that have similarities, we're working with that person as a unique case and focusing on what they want to be doing and what they're working on to move forward with their goals. And then, of course, social and community integration. Today I'm here about our Clark Homeless Engagement Collaboration. We call it CHECK for short because that's a lot of words. We are asking for $250,000 in rental assistance and $50,000 from CDBG funds to help provide case management services. The rental assistance will help house individual and family households with a rapid rehousing model, and we're targeting a 6-month maximum financial rental assistance. Our rental assistance, so obviously 6 months is a short time frame to be turning around, but one of the parts that we're working on with our case management is getting the added support systems in place, so helping them get involved with mental health services, substance use services, education and employment services too, so they have a whole wraparound team moving them forward so they can quickly be able to have housing stability within that 6 months. Our case management is community-based, so that means we are providing intensive community-based case management services. We're working with individuals in the home or in the community, wherever they're comfortable, meeting them where they're at and helping them connect to the support services that they need in their life. Our case management services are based on the individual needs, but they frequently do not occur less than once a week. And then our case managers are focusing on the holistic approach. So we're working on behavioral health, primary care, vocational supports, national support systems, and community integration. So what makes CHECK different? You guys are gonna hear presentations for a few different TBRA programs here today. Our program focuses on behavioral health populations. So being a part of a behavioral health organization, we are connected and have ongoing exposure and training to evidence-based practices that work with individuals with mental health and substance use disorders. Additionally, we have a monthly supervision with a mental health supervisor, so we're able to do case consultation and get feedback and ongoing training to help better facilitate and support the needs of the individuals we're working with who have that mental health and substance use disorder needs. We also have in-house consultation services available for both mental health and substance use disorder clients. So at any time that we're struggling with an individual or that we need added supports to move forward, we'll be able to get that. And then, of course, being in-house, too, we kind of have effective wraparound case management support with everybody that's involved with the individual, from mental health, substance use, and peer support. So our 2017 check, last year I was here giving this presentation and we were awarded funding. Our check program was delayed slightly because of funding, so we officially received funding on November 14th and requested our first referral the next day on November 14th. To date, we've asked for 10 referrals from the Housing Solutions Center and 4 have been received. 2 of those are already moved into the housing and are working on their self-sufficiency. The other 2, actually, since I've done this, are finishing up the process of applying to housing and will be moving in this week as well. As a whole, our CSNW housing outcomes, 70% of our program graduates have housing stability for longer than a year, 60% of our program graduates increase their income, and 85% of our program graduates are engaged with ongoing support services, whether that be mental health, substance use treatment, peer support, or vocational treatment, or even all of the above.
We're 20 seconds over.
20 seconds over. Man!
Any questions?
How many dollars is that worth? No.
$1.
$1,000 a second.
Can you go back to the last slide? Just so I can look at it, please. Thank you. When you say 70% of housing stability for 1 year or longer, are you saying that they're in your program for 1 year or longer, or 70% of them after they're out of your program find housing?
These outcomes are based on all of our housing programs together. So this is going to be our permanent supportive and our rapid rehousing. Our permanent supportive programs are individuals who are receiving housing assistance indefinitely.
And that's where the 70% is?
So the 70% is a mixture of all the programs that we have together. So it does include the permanent supportive who have the ongoing assistance and the rapid rehousing folks who graduate and are self-sufficient on their income.
How many people you serve in a year?
Total in our department?
Yeah.
Over 50 individual households.
How many do you expect to serve with this program, with this funding request?
With this funding, so we're basing it off of the same model last year, so our hope is to do 50 unique households in 12 months. So we're bringing in 5 new referrals each month for the rapid rehousing program.
I'm always surprised at the 6-month maximum rent when you propose it, because I believe the population you're looking for, if I remember your proposal correctly, is people who experience chronic homelessness or they're high needs, mm-hmm. and they have quite a few barriers to housing.
Yes, so that's one of the ones, that's a great question. So what we do is, so the rapid rehousing folks are, for those who don't know, the Housing Solutions Center does all of our intakes and kind of coordinated entry and referrals. So they recently changed their threshold for rapid rehousing levels. So we are seeing more individuals who are kind of on that brink of needing permanent, supportive, long-term, indefinite housing, and then the folks who just have a few barriers. So when we're targeting those individuals who are falling into the who are categorized as chronically homeless, but are also falling into that 6-month, the rapid rehousing population, while they do have a chronic homelessness, they also have minimal barriers to moving in. So we're able to get them moved in rather quickly. They don't have nearly as many evictions or challenges to getting into housing or moving past that landlord stage. So we're able to get them in, but then we have a lot of different wraparound services. So then folks coming into the rapid rehousing program know ahead of time that they have a very short time frame for the financial assistance. So we're hitting the ground running with them as soon as we start working with them, getting them involved with employment support services, addressing the immediate needs, whether that be primary care, mental health, or substance use. And then making sure we have as many different community services involved with that individual based on what their need is, so that if we can, in best cases, they'll be able to be self-sufficient within that 6 months.
One not a question, comment, but in future years, it would be really helpful for me to see the housing outcomes for the program for which you are requesting the funding. Because that'd make an easier comparison of, your program to, Janice or Cher.
you very much.
Thank you, guys.
And next we have Janice. And 5 minutes presentation, 5 minutes question at 4 minute mark.
Sounds good.
Okay.
I'm Scott Conger with Janice Youth Program. This is Dennis Morrow, the executive director. We're not going to have any PowerPoint. We're just going to talk to you, tell you about the program. So the funds we're requesting today are to help hard-to-reach, high-risk homeless youth. Janice itself has over 35, there are over 40 programs. We're the largest youth provider in the Northwest. We're the only homeless youth provider in Clark County. These funds are used to help high-risk youth that we noticed there was a gap in services 2 years ago. So we've had a number of different programs in Clark County for the past 10 years. We've been doing homeless youth programs for over 40 years. But in the last 10 years, we've been in Clark County. Over those years, we have an outreach team, a drop-in center, and numerous housing programs. But during that time, we noticed that there was a gap in services, that we were missing youth that we would work with for a long time that would graduate into the adult homeless system. So we weren't able to serve them. So these funds are directed to capitalize on those, not capitalize, but to utilize those relationships that we've developed over the years with these hard-to-reach homeless youth. With that said, let me just say that over the last 20 years of doing this, I've never seen any funding have a bigger impact on the homeless youth population than these funds have. We've been able to target these youth that in the past, so we're coming up on our 2 year mark. So we got these funds 2 years ago specifically to address this population. And in the past, where we go on outreach and see the youth that we work with as adults in the homeless community, that's stopped. We've utilized these funds to target this population that we know have been on the homeless since they were teenagers, and we're able to house them. And it's having a remarkable effect on the homeless youth population. The youth that we've housed have become role models for the youth that are still on the street. There's a lot of families. Homeless individuals create families, and those families are helping the others to become housed with these funds too. So we've never seen anything where we've housed individuals that are inspirational to other individuals that are on the street. And we're looking at these funds as the last funding that these youth will ever need. We've helped over 20 households, and we've had over a 90% success rate of them becoming self-sufficient. So that's them going off funding, getting jobs or some sort of income that they become self-sufficient on their own. So these funds, we look at as an investment to the future of the homeless community in general. The way, if we're able to help youth get off the streets before they become street entrenched, this is an investment to the community in preventing homelessness in general and community. You have anything else?
Well, just the federal government set up a target a few years back to end youth homelessness by 2020, mm-hmm. And I really thought they had already been using the drug, only recently legalized in Oregon when they did that, because it didn't seem like a realistic possibility. But when Scott started showing me what's happening, we are seeing a diminished presence, and the same thing's happening in Portland. As housing programs go up, we are seeing fewer youth on the street. I did a calculation a couple years ago for a group I was working with, and I said, what's the savings? What's the return on investment to the community? If you take a 24-year-old youth and they age into the adult system at 25 or 26, that youth at that point will, on average, cost a minimum of $1 million to the community for services, whether you're talking about foster care for their kids, mental health services, jail time, medical emergency medical room visits, but at least $1 million in services. So when we stop, we're ending the cycle of homelessness, but we're also having a huge savings that can get reinvested into the community. And that, I don't think there is a program in the country that is having the success that Scott has been having. And we are talking now housing retention. When he says 90%, we're not in housing now. We're saying housing retention after we leave. We're aiming for 90% of those youth. And when we talk about 20 households, the other thing is many of these are actually young homeless youth with children. So many of the households we're serving also are minor, really small kids as well.
And we attribute a lot of our success to the case management portion. We work hard, intensive case management. to help these youth develop life skills that they can have when they leave the program as well. We joke that our drop-in center says we're putting them out of a job because we're housing all their youth. So, yes. Any other questions?
What kind of an increase are you seeing? It almost sounds like you're seeing a decrease, but that's hard for me to believe.
Well, there's always going to be, ending homelessness is a lofty
goal. I would think, I don't know, but I'm guessing that it's a lot higher than it was.
Yeah, what we're seeing, there's a constant flow of youth onto the streets, but the ending homelessness is we're getting them housed so they're not becoming the adult homeless population. That's what we're seeing. They're not becoming, we have not nearly as many who are in the chronic possibility. We're seeing the new ones on the street that we have other programs we
can get to. Or at least the ones that you serve.
But these are the population for this are people with youth with severe mental health issues. These are youth transitioning out of foster care or out of institutions, coming back after being in an institutional stay. They're really the highest needs and highest risk group that we've got. And this program is really developed because you have to have specialized services. You have to have longer rental assistance. The question asked with the other people, this one has to be a longer-term rental assistance because they have to be able to get there, get employed, get stable, get mental health services, get AND services, get parenting, and then. But in 2 years, we can do that, and that's been the exciting thing.
How do they come to you? Sorry.
We use the Housing Solutions Center. Everything, all the referrals come through the Housing Solutions Center. We have a program that we can help get the youth that we work with, we can refer to the Housing Solutions Center, they do the assessment. So that's where the target of these funding has been so beneficial, is we've been able to target that population.
Yeah, we have a drop-in center in downtown Vancouver that the youth all know about and access, so they can be a referral network into the Housing Solutions Center. Then we also have mobile street outreach workers. We're going all over the county actually looking for youth and going into camps and finding them. So the referrals are generally self-generated by our other programs.
I was just wanting clarification.
I mean, SHARE can do in community services in Northwest, but we're targeted to homeless youth. We are age-specific, tailored services to homeless youth. But I don't know, Bunk, you guys get 25-year-old individuals, right?
Yeah.
So, thanks. Any other questions?
Thanks for your work. Just when you're talking about Janice, we didn't plan on getting this big, but the community demand has required it. But we actually work with over 6,000 youth every year in a program somewhere, and most of them are in our programs for runaway homeless youth. And I can tell you, when I look across Multnomah County and Clark County, and we're also up in Cowles County now, beginning to work with the youth up there, sex traffic victims and minor unaccompanied youth, I don't see a program anywhere that we operate that has a stronger impact on this concept of really ending homelessness than this one does. And I'm not saying that just to BS you, I'm saying this is something I've just gotten so proud of and excited about over the last year as we've seen this program mature. So whatever you put into it, it will be $1 million investment.
It's really amazing to see the outcome that these specific funds have had. So thank you for the last 2 years of having that available to us.
Yeah, you pioneered something that doesn't really exist anywhere in the country at this level. So.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Stefan here.
Time-ins question at the 4 minute mark. I'll give you the mail. I'm ready when you are.
Jared Salmon, I'm the CEO of Lifeline Connections.
Jerry Shoemate. She's the Fund Development Director for Lifeline Connections. Lifeline, for those of you who don't know, is a community behavioral health organization based out of Vancouver. We've been in our community for over 50 years. Our original name back in 1962 when we were founded was the Clark County Council on Alcoholism. And so through the years, we've added more services, served more individuals, and grown to where right now we're the largest provider of substance abuse treatment in the county. And not only do we do substance abuse treatment, but mental health treatment as well. So a full continuum of services from inpatient care to outpatient care. And as this presentation will talk about, we're looking more into doing more housing and other services to help serve our individuals. So our request is money to help some of the individuals we serve every year access housing. And I'll also highlight why it's important that behavioral health organizations like the one I work at provide housing supports to individuals. We're looking at some assistance to help with security deposits, application fees, and we're also looking for some funding to help with covering the costs of a case manager position as well. Okay. So it's the scope of the problem. An estimated 8.4% of people in the U.S. experience a substance use disorder, while 38% of people experiencing chronic homelessness are addicted to alcohol. 26% of people are addicted to alcohol. An estimated 4% of people in the U.S. experience a serious illness, while 30% of people experiencing chronic homelessness and a serious illness. So these are the people that come to Lifeline to receive services, and we know that firsthand that a lot of these individuals have housing instability. And we have found through the years that helping address their housing issues also can impact their behavioral health. It is hard to treat somebody for a substance use disorder or a mental health condition if they don't have a safe place to live and go sleep at the end of the day. And so that's where Lifeline and our board of directors has decided that we need to do more housing. We need to help individuals who are coming out of our inpatient programs or in our outpatient programs access housing. And we do that with a couple, we've done that already with partnerships with other housing agencies, but we're also looking to do that some of ourselves just to help with the coordination between treatment and housing. Next. This is an interesting study that I thought kind of hits home to the importance of addressing housing almost as a treatment approach as well. A study in Boston found that individuals experiencing homelessness were 9 times more likely to die from an opiate overdose than those who were stably housed. The National Coalition for the Homeless State says substance abuse is both the cause and the result of homelessness. Both issues need to be addressed simultaneously. Stable housing during and after treatment decreases the risk of relapse. Substance abuse treatment on its own is inadequate and needs to be combined with supportive housing opportunities. So as I'm sure many of you are aware, we are in the midst of an opioid epidemic. Our community is not exempt from that. We have individuals in our community who find themselves addicted to heroin and opiate-based painkillers. And as this points out, these individuals who aren't housed have a higher overdose rate. So it's once again, it's kind of going back and forth to having housing and treatment programs. Recovery housing, it's a nationally recognized model tailored to those in early recovery, according to HUD. Housing, recovery housing uses substance use specific services, peer support, and physical design features to support individuals and families. On a particular path to recovery from addiction, typically emphasizing abstinence or using medication assisted treatment as well in conjunction with the housing, after using other medications to help individuals who might be addicted to it, who have an opiate use disorder. So, this is an approach where we provide them with support. They're typically newer in recovery, they're kind of learning how to live sober, clean and sober lives. And this is a housing approach that helps them make that path, helps them get back on their feet, help them to become productive members of our community once again. Next. The program across the river here that nonprofit that you might be familiar with is Treatment Housing, also job supports. They have recovery housing as well, and they shared some statistics not too long ago about their recovery housing program, which states 64% of program participants have either earned income or government benefits and entitlements. Of those who graduate treatment, move on to permanent housing, 89%, and maintain their new housing once 1 year later. So this is not a new model. This is something that's been tried with other treatment programs, new housing, and once again, it's the kind of marriage, you know, the treatment side and the housing side makes sense. That's been done before. So leveraging other funds. So in addition to the funds that we're requesting today, we plan on using other funds as well. We are approved to be a Medicaid provider of supportive housing services, so we'll be able to provide assistance to individuals to help them stay and find housing and stay housed, and we will be billing Medicaid for that. We're also looking at other supports from other local, state, and of course this body to provide that rental assistance. The Medicaid money does not assist individuals with rent. That's why we need to marry multiple funding sources to this housing program. And we also seek a private philanthropic support as well. We just received some money from the Canvas Social Community Chest to help mothers who have a substance use disorder find and sustain housing. Next. That is it. So any questions for me or Jerry?
Could you talk a little bit more about the recovery housing and how that fits in with Housing First? What happens if somebody relapses or relapses more than once while you're housing them?
We believe that a substance use disorder or any kind of behavioral health condition is a chronic disease. You can go to chronic illnesses like hypertension, diabetes.
Can I ask you to speak up just a
Sorry. Question? So we believe that a substance use disorder is a chronic illness. So because as any type of illness, we believe that some people take a step forward and sometimes take steps back. And so because of that, we don't believe in punishing individuals if they end up in a relapse situation. So if they're in a housing program, we want to, that's why it's so important that we marry treatment and housing. The treatment provider can go in, provide assistance to that person who might have relapsed, and identify what's going on, do you need more treatment, do you need more engagement to help them stay on that path. So does that answer your question, Sam?
So they can't, they're never in danger of losing the housing.
Correct. Yes.
The rules, the policies are say there's minimal barriers to entry. You don't have to have long periods of sobriety. You don't have to have a certain income or criminal record or clear eviction histories. Those are not issues. And relapse is not an automatic cause for eviction. If there's, you know, problematic behaviors go along with it, as in with any other tenant-based relationship, possibly, but not relapse.
Thank you. Are these houses that you're putting people in, or is it part of your facility that you already have?
So the advice that we're requesting is to help with rental assistance in a multitude of venues. So that could be our own housing, that could be scattered site. We partner with Second Step Housing, use of their housing. We're in a partnership with Vancouver Housing Authority for a potential complex going up this spring and summer. And we're also looking at our own housing as well. So
will they be in like shared housing, individual units? I guess
both.
Okay.
Both. It could be both two scenarios.
And it would be shared housing with other people in the program?
Yes.
Okay. The other piece I would mention is that the recovery housing model, HUD is very specific about saying it's not in conflict with Housing First if services align with participants' choice and prioritization of their own goals of sustained recovery and abstinence. And there's also a phrase that says if a person chooses to leave or is asked to leave because of problem behaviors, they can apply to come back in. So it's you're constantly able to re-access, even if by your own actions and choice you leave the housing.
We have to try and test and model with individuals who have a substance use disorder. It's helping them, surrounding them with other people who have like lived experiences that helps them along their way to recovery. So we find that in some situations, you know, a group living dynamic really helps someone early in recovery versus them being by themselves in a single apartment. That might not work for everybody, but some individuals, that's an option that works very well.
So these funds with, home and CDBG, home's TBRA, it requires a state HUD, HUD standards of a regular lease, and any of housing you provide with these
yes.
would meet that.
It would.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And next we have Cher with Aspire Rental Assistance and Case Management.
Everybody, my name is Juanita. I'm a housing case manager at Share Aspire, so I provide direct care services in housing and stability for our clients. So I get to see firsthand how your funding impacts for the positive in our community. The main two goals of the CDBG home program is to get our clients stably housed, but also to get them self-sufficient in 24 months period of time or less, depending on their needs. So our goal isn't just to get them stably housed, but to keep them stably housed and make sure that they are successful in the future. We are operating the Housing First, strengths-based, and trauma-informed care model by empowering them to self-sufficiency. Our funding first, again, is with placement, where we take clients that are at homeless or at risk of homelessness. We assess, plan, implement, monitor, and evaluate all their options necessary to meet their health and human care needs. Once we've determined that their needs and how to move forward with their barriers into getting them housed, we then begin to do the housing search, where we're really involved in that process with them. We're from start to finish involved, so we reach out to over 100 landlords that we are in network with, both private and nonprofit, that will be willing to work with our clients. We want to get them into a house that works for them, that they, again, would be able to be self-sufficient moving forward as the plan. When I say support them for the application process, we've already kind of assessed their barriers and their barriers to getting housing, so, you know, we make sure that we work with them directly and the landlords to provide the advocacy once they're in their application. Then once they're housed, we focus on intensive care management with a tool that we use called Housing Stability Plan. This is for us to assess their short and long-term goals, individualized care. Examples that are on our Housing Stability Plan that we developed from start are could be like setting realistic goals, debt consolidation, credit management, basic life skills, sobriety, employment goals, and referrals to outside services. We are an advocate liaison to outside services. We work with partners in the community, and we do provide that wraparound of services as needed. Again, the Housing Stability Plan is a living document, so we manipulate it often. We refer to it often. We want our clients to be empowered by seeing their goals being achieved, and so we remove things as they go on and add things too, and it's a really useful tool for them because they can see themselves the impact that, you know, the changes that are being made in their lives. We also utilize, we have a classroom that we utilize at the Fromhold Center, and there we conduct RentWell training classes. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but it's a six-week tenant education class where they receive kind of an extra support to show the landlords that they've done this training. Also, there's like a $1,000 extra benefit kind of attached to graduating to this that's to be used for the landlord if the client moves out and has some issues with paying, you know, the fees for moving out. We have that extra support. We're certified RentWell instructors as case managers at Share, so there's plenty of us to be able to provide those classes for our clients to make sure they're successful. We also do financial education classes and conduct supportive services meetings once a month. With 1 minute left, I do want to share a client story because this is really important to me. She is my client. She just graduated. It's a personal story of hers that she's agreed to let me share with y'all. Prior to entering the program, this woman was 35 weeks pregnant, living in a van with her partner, and had struggled with homelessness on and off for 2 years. She was arrested in 2010 for possession of methamphetamine, however, was currently sober still smoking marijuana occasionally. Her partner and father of her unborn child continued to struggle with substance abuse, chemical dependency, and became physically abusive to her. Feeling as though she had no other option of support, she remained in the relationship. She only completed 11th grade and was receiving TANF and SNAP benefits. When she delivered her child in January 2015, Child Protective Services became involved and removed her child, care and control, and supervision, taking temporary custody of her infant due to domestic violence and homelessness. Shortly after delivering her son, Aspire was able to assist this mother with securing stable housing, and at that time, her son was returned to her care and control and supervision. However, the case remained open. One of the conditions of her child's return was that the father could not be home or around the child, and she was able to secure a restraining order against her abuser through the help of her case manager. During the time on the program, she slowly began to rebuild. She was referred to Partners in Careers through DSHS. She began working for Habitat for Humanity and really enjoyed the work and her coworkers. She then began to abstain from marijuana and believed this would open up employment doors for her. She began to make and keep a work schedule through PIC contract and received glowing reviews from her employer. Eager to become self-sufficient, she then enrolled in GED classes and began to look for part-time employment. In July of 2016, her CPS case was closed and she obtained full custody of her son. By September of 2016, she passed all the required testing to receive her GED certificate with the exception of math. With one more month left on the PIC program, she continued to pursue part-time employment, but felt without her GED, she could not get the employment she needed to sustain, so she kept on trying for that. When the PIC contract ended, she was referred to WorkSource. In February of 17, she began a new contract with Partners in Careers. However, this was unpaid employment experience to add to her resume, gain skills, and to stay busy until she was able to secure full-time employment. Shortly after that, she was able to obtain a part-time front desk position at Columbia River Mental Health. After 30 days of training, she became a paid employee. Soon after that, she passed her final test for GED and obtained her certificate. She continued to thrive, attending monthly supportive services meetings through Share Aspire and began to save $300 a month. Her son, now a toddler, was thriving as well and attending school at Innovative Services. 2 months prior to graduating the program, she was offered a full-time permanent employment through mental health facility. 1 more month before graduating the program, she was offered a promotion and a pay increase. After successfully gaining employment and saving enough money, she was able to comfortably transition into paying her own rent without subsidy. She states over and over again how the program gave her confidence, helped her utilize tools she learned to become self-sufficient, and she feels, end quote, would not be where I am today without Share Aspire and the support of my case manager.
You're past time. Questions?
How many people will this serve?
The application is for 50. Last year we served 57 with the county, and we have a 78% success rate. And the success rate is managed by looking at clients that have graduated for at least 1 year to see that they don't come back, and we know that through the HMIS system.
So the funding's for rent assistance?
It's a subsidy, and the clients pay no more than 30% of their rent towards rent up to 24 months.
And then the CDBG pays for the case management, which we feel is a real key to making them successful. Just handing them rent subsidy wouldn't get the same results.
Yeah, and intensive case management is like as often as once a week in the beginning, just to kind of address all their needs, because there's quite a bit when they first come on, and that kind of slowly trickles down to at no minimum of once a month.
Thank you.
Thanks for your work.
And next we have Salvation Army Guiding Light.
Timely, just me.
passing out a summary sheet, gives you an idea of kind of what my talking points are. Salvation Army has undergone a name change for the program that we've applied for, as noted in our application, moving from Guiding Light back to a more familiar name of Moving Forward Together. Our housing programs all fall under the umbrella of that program. Moving Forward Together was launched about 12 years ago. It's an integrated approach to food, housing, and education and employment. And so we partner with a number of other providers who help support the client in the process of gaining housing stability. In the familiar way of answering the who, what, where, why, and how, I would like to turn to the handout that I gave you. So we're in the business of providing basic immediate assistance to those in most need, and we have a long term experience of outreach in doing that with many people in our community. Both landlords and clients are familiar in seeking out help from the Salvation Army as a beacon in dark places. What we do is, particularly as it relates to this funding, is to find stable housing for those who are homeless or at risk of homelessness. We work closely with the Housing Solutions Center under the auspices of the Council for the Homeless, and we are in touch with them on a daily basis, either making referrals to them or getting referrals from them. Of course, why we do what we do is because there's a huge need. You know, many people are paying more than 60% of their income on housing, and that's just not right, and it doesn't take long for someone to fall behind and into a financial crisis. We know that on any given night, over 2,500 children can be homeless, either in shelters, living in cars, or couch surfing. That's not a good scenario for us here in Clark County, but it's a fact. And so we want to be available to address those needs. And we have ways of doing that. So we go about taking those referrals from the Housing Solutions Center, as well as many others, providing rent, move-in costs, deposits, utility assistance where appropriate. So we truly want to help the person become financially stable and maintain their housing. So with $140,000, it breaks out simply to help 30 clients. In providing, our experience tells us, in an average of 6 months assistance, that equals about $4,600 per household, and that gives them about $780 a month in assistance from us. Again, flexible in how we use those funds. And where we do the assistance, as I mentioned earlier this morning, we have three outreach service offices, Camas Washougal, Salvation Army Family Services on 47th Avenue in the Minnehaha area, and then also on 112th, where we have our administration and youth program offices. We do see homeless families and work with the Evergreen School District in servicing those homeless families through our after-school program. Questions?
You keep referring to at risk of homelessness, and you know, one of the requirements is this is funding for people people experiencing homelessness. So could you just please confirm that this is not prevention dollars, it's only rapid rehousing?
Correct. Okay. So these particular dollars are to address the people who are homeless. We have other dollars to address prevention. And while case management and other supportive services are voluntary for folks receiving these dollars, they are offered, but not required. Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, sure. Oh. To go back.
I just have a really good question. Okay. You quoted 50 people that you'd be helping, but the application said 30. I was just curious where
the application says 30
for the grant application.
So that's my error then. But we did
okay,
help
so
57 30. Last year, so I think that 50 is a more realistic number.
Oh.
Households, not people.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I just want clarification.
Yeah. And is Foundation for a Challenge here? It's here. Okay. And as we've been doing, we have 4 minute mark. I'll give you this. 5 minutes questions. Are you ready when you are?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Jan DeVar. I'm representing Foundation for the Challenged. We are proposing one purchase of one house to serve persons with developmental disabilities. So this is a special needs housing project. We'll purchase the house on the open market. Here is the first one we've done in Clark County. Foundation has a portfolio of 40 of these houses in the corridor, mainly, some in Spokane. So, but this is the first one here. Last year, I believe you awarded us $50,000, and I'll get into that a little bit later. So we'll purchase a three-bedroom house. We're going to do a lot of ADA to it when we get it. Wheelchair accessibility, roll-in showers, ADA lock sets, front and back ramps to the front door. We'll be wired into the fire department for fire suppression. These are all pretty standard operating procedures to remodel these houses. We'll widen doorways. The tenants are referred by DSHS. They are all DDA clients. When there's a vacancy, it will also be referred by DSHS. The local caregiver is VanCare. We've worked peripherally with VanCare before. So a typical client is someone requiring 24-hour care, currently probably living in unaffordable or unsafe conditions. We're starting to see some evictions because of the rising rental costs, especially in King County, where they're being forced out and there's nowhere for them to go that's affordable. It's pretty bleak out there and it's just moving. And I'm sure Vancouver's getting hit too. So they usually have income around $800 a month, and this is, of course, with the Housing Trust Fund, because that's the other funder here. 40-year commitment. They'll pay approximately $150 a month each. So it'll be three tenants, 24/7 care. The budget. As I said, we got $50,000 from Clark County last year. This project is one of six houses that we have into the Housing Trust Fund, which we're currently waiting for the Trust Fund to announce awards. They were delayed since December because of the budget, the capital budget. So it's signed, I believe Thursday is the deadline for addendums, and then they should make awards in March. So the six houses, we've got two in Thurston, two in Cowlitz, one in Pierce, and this one in Clark. The reason for a return for additional money, we've had numerous conversations this year with the trust fund, and of course increasing competition for the dollar. All of the other five houses have committed local funds. This one needs more for leverage. So where we'll get $150,000 with this award through Clark, the $372,000 from the trust fund. The budget for this house is $552,000. That's acquisition and rehab. Remember, this is a 40-year commitment, and these are long-term clients of DSHS. They're adults over 21, currently living in the community. Questions?
I have lots of questions.
Okay, bring them on.
So I'm just curious about why this facility as opposed to other adult family homes?
This is a group home, entitled a group home versus adult family homes. They're all on a continuum. There's room for everybody. So these are, I think you're maybe familiar with Inland Empire, who's done some of the group homes here in prior times. This is just our first one here. It's a similar house.
And then, well, now that I think about it, I'm losing my questions, but how, you said they're referred to DSHS?
Yes. Correct.
Is there some sort of something unique to them that they need this house?
They are currently living in the community, all these clients. Like VanCare is already serving. They have already identified three clients that are needing affordable housing. Maybe their housing, a lot of times it's even unsafe. It's not a desirable housing at all. So they're currently in the community and needing placement or being evicted, a number of things.
These are mentally handicapped adults, correct?
Developmentally disabled. So
okay.
That's a category.
So I can speak on this because I rent my house out in King County, five bedroom through that home.
There you go.
To mentally disabled. It's a great program that I, as a landlord, have three individuals that are in that are mentally disabled. Is that the correct term?
Whatever.
My apologies. They do have a full time caretaker. You're talking about a three bedroom home.
Correct.
Where is your caretaker staying?
It's
20 three adults.
It's 24/7 services, so there's shifts.
Okay, so
someone doesn't live in the
office house,
but
yeah.
there's someone that's there all the time.
Right, but where's their office and their quarters if you're only doing three bedroom? Because typically, where in my home they have a room that's set aside for the caretaker to go in and out, and then they have an alarm system so they can't, you know,
right.
get out of the home.
Not always. Sometimes they're set up in the kitchen. Sometimes off. Space off the dining room. We don't always have the four bedroom house.
Right, and you work on a program that also has them go into working and they have transportation.
If they're able.
Correct.
The difference probably is your folks, there is a difference between mental health and developmentally disabled.
Yeah.
Developmentally disabled most of the time cannot work. They may have some volunteer activities,
okay.
but they're pretty much driven around by a van. I mean,
right.
just a very few of them can work, yes?
So I do have a couple. So the VanCare, that's something that they get through, like the state that is paid for.
VanCare is a service provider, meaning they're paid for the service. It's kind of a triangle between DSHS, the service provider, and us as the housing provider.
Okay, and you're just.
And we're all in contract with each other.
Okay, and then I'm sorry if this sounds insensitive, but there's a lot of group homes for like people who are.
No,
so
it's not that.
Okay, that's all I want.
We don't do with that population.
Okay, thank you.
That's a special population that needs real care and finesse. No.
I just wanted to make it clear to the board that this application is either for CDBG or home funds.
Correct. We'll
not
take either.
Both, but we encourage them to apply for both, not knowing where more funding availability might be. So.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. We can deal with either. Either funding source.
Other questions?
Oh, my last question. Did you say you knew when you would have the commitment of the other state funds?
Well, we're just waiting now. The 15th was their deadline for any updates, and they haven't said when they're going to announce yet. But since they used to work for the trust fund, it'll be about 2 to 3 weeks. They should be able to announce awards.
Before our March meeting here.
When's the March meeting?
It's the second Monday of March. I think it's March 12th.
March 12th.
The sooner the better. I mean, we're anxious too. Like I said, all the other five communities, we have all the local funding already committed, and we've just been waiting. But like I said, it's just there's 2,190,000 available for persons with developmental disabilities that's set aside in the trust fund for this biennium, and we're asking for 1.9 for these six houses. There's only one other applicant, so. We'll see. We're pretty positive. We're usually funded.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Well, thank you for
thank
a
you.
Beautiful day for me to drive down here.
And crowd ground, I know that we're like 5 minutes early, but will you be ready? Like, to present now? Okay, thank you. Y'all are less than 5 minutes early.
My name is Jackie Keough. I'm the Fund Development Manager at Crowd Ground, and this is Katie Ulrich, our long-term homeownership director. Crowd Ground first wants to thank Clark County for its long-term support of this program. For those of you who may be new or refresher, we're going to go through our new application. So, as you may or may not know, Crowd Ground is a nonprofit that uses the community land trust model to provide permanent affordable homeownership opportunities for low and moderate income residents in Oregon and Southwest Washington, including a long history in Clark County. We educate and counsel first-time homebuyers between 60 and 80% area median income. And so far, we've educated and counseled 350 families. All of the homes that Proud Ground has in its portfolio, 278 to date, are stewarded by our community land trust model and maintain their affordability forever. So they're passed on to other low-income buyers.
Great. So what we do is we basically leverage community investment into every home purchase. And so we utilize, in this application, we've asked for either or both, CDBG and home funds. So we bring in substantial down payments to make that home affordable to a first-time home buyer. We also provide education and counseling, also in partnership with Community Housing Resource Center in Vancouver. The home buyer themselves qualifies for their own mortgage, and so they are mortgage ready. They go to the bank and get a traditional mortgage, and it's at a price that they can afford, not necessarily the prices that are available out there in the market. So, in the end, basically what we do with that leveraging of that money is we become the owner of the land under the home, and that is what ensures that the home remains affordable into the future if or when that family decides to sell. So it's behind me now, and I'm trying to, oh my goodness, okay. So basically, as you can see from our application, I don't have to sit here and tell you that homes are unaffordable to many working households in Clark County. But basically, the median sales price of a home, a family would need to earn about $80,000 a year to qualify for a mortgage of that amount, or they'd need to save a substantial down payment to make that happen. So our target audience is basically between 60 and 80% of the area median income, so a household earning about $40,000 to $55,000 a year.
So Proud Ground has done numerous studies, and this kind of goes through our quick model. So Maria, comparatively, going through the top level of working with Proud Ground, the bottom level is renting long-term. And so using our model here, if Maria was to rent, who has a full-time job and 3 children, she would, at the end of kind of 10 years after rental costs and moving costs and increasing rent, and absolutely no equity being gained, would lose about $180,000. And comparatively, working with Proud Ground, she can become a first-time home buyer by about $238,000 would be her home price. We would reduce that, for example, to $165,000 with the support of grantors like you. Maria's house payments would be $100 less than what she was actually paying in rent,
And over time, using Pride Ground's resale formula, she does generate equity. So after 10 years to date, Maria would generate $76,000 in equity of her home. That's an old infographic, so we've seen increases since that, $60,000. And so the long story short is that not only does homeownership help rental families because you move a family out of the rental market into homeownership, freeing up that rental, but you're allowing these low-income families to really create equity and wealth.
So our proposal is we recognize that we can't actually be awarded the amount that we asked for, but we did apply for both because we can utilize both CDBG or home, so that's for flexibility in your funding. With an award of, basically we would plan to utilize about $83,000 of either CDBG or home to buy down the purchase price of a home. Proud Ground would also bring in an additional minimum of an additional $10,000 of our own subsidy or find it through another federal source. And then the buyer actually pays a majority of the purchase price for that home, and that's from their mortgage that they get. So, and we've, this is a little slide, and we have it in our thing about how many, I know it's a lot of money per buyer to assist, but once these homes become part of our portfolio of homes in Clark County, they are available upon resale to another income-qualified household. So we use some estimates to determine for the lifetime of that home how many families we think we could serve with that investment in a specific home. And we wanted to highlight that actually this last summer we saw it work really well. We did have one of the homes that was previously funded by Clark County resold. The family actually got a job transfer to Hawaii, and they had to sell. They had only owned their home for a couple years. And what was great was that home did become another permanently affordable home, so we were able to sell it well below the market value. The family, after owning it for a couple years, got some equity out of it for their move. And we were able to serve another low-income family through the program without additional funding at that time.
And so Proud Ground has a long history of doing this.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
Yeah. So far we have 13 permanently affordable homes created by this funding source. 9 are completed and 4 are in process right now from last year's award. And so you can just look at the average median income. It's very low. We're serving kind of priority families with families of color, families with children, female-led households. And you can see the average sales price of the homeowner pays is significantly reduced in the market value. And that's it. So questions?
Yeah. So you spoke about they were able to get into the house and you reduced their price by about $100 a month versus what they would rent for. Mm-hmm. But there's also other considerations to take into account, which you guys are familiar with. The electric bill goes up, their water, sewer, garbage is not paid for any longer, now they're paying that cost. So did that $100 savings include that?
That's a great question. It did not in that calculation, but as a HUD-approved counseling agency, we definitely are working with our buyers to make sure they fully understand the full cost of homeownership. Yeah.
And what about the maintenance in the home? So is many times if they can't, maintenance is included when you rent, and so is your lawn care and you're mowing your lawn and everything else. What about those costs?
Yeah, so our homeowners are responsible for the maintenance and upkeep of their homes, as any homeowner. And we do provide resources post-purchase, so we have some free workshops where we talk about, do-it-yourself kind of stuff as well. And we're also looking to actively connect our homeowners in Clark County with other resources in the community for access to home repair needs and things like that. I would say, I've been there with Proud Ground about 13 years, and my experience with our homeowners is probably the same as a market rate homeowners, as far as there's people that own their homes full out and don't maintain their homes, and then there's people that do a really good job. So we do provide the tools, but we also have a mechanism actually through our legal agreement with our owners for that, ensuring that they do have that upkeep.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I just want to add that, Katie, so HUD requires an environmental review on each property, and it has to be brought up, make sure that the house meets all of the HUD standards, and Proud Ground will put that. Part of that $10,000 usually that Proud Ground puts in is for rehab or any items that the house needs to make sure it's good to go when they first get it.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. Yeah, I was thinking more like 10 years down the road.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Purchase,
thinking,
yeah.
Well, you know, you talk about this family that went to Hawaii and now
yes.
this house comes back on the market. What do you have to do to get in shape for the next person
yeah.
to move mm-hmm. in? What money, what funds are used to make that house in a desirable shape for that new family moving in? And do you take care of that cost or?
Good question.
Or, so.
It's yeah, it's negotiation upon.
But I would also say that part of our resale formula is based on how well the home is preserved.
Yeah.
So that incentivizes the family to kind of maintain or improve kind of the house.
So is the goal for permanent home ownership or for people to use this as a stepping ground? Because you've shown how much equity they have. But
yeah. So, yeah, we, I think our goal, I mean, it's, good question, and I would say that's pretty individual to each of the homeowners. I mean, some of these homeowners are going to be there probably for the rest of their lives, and then some of them, just like a market rate homeowner, they're going to turn over. And our real goal and mission is, if or when it turns over, ensuring that it stays affordable to another family behind them.
And it only stays in your program because you own the land and
right.
the house.
Right. So what sells every time is just the house on top of the land. The new owner enters into the same long-term legal agreement.
And it stays permanently affordable. And so we did kind of a look at how many families kind of do sell. So we right now are about 15% of the 350 families we have in our serve have sold. So that gives you, and so most people are staying in their homes and preserving that long-term permanent affordability. But others, of course, would use it as a stepping stone. We would say most people do it because of life changes, right? Moving, marriage, divorce,
yeah, same
like that. Same like a market rate.
Jen, I have one more question.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's probably getting into the weeds, but how do people become eligible, or where do you get people who are potential
yeah.
homeowners in the program?
That's a great question. So Private Ground has worked with Clark County, for example. We have a wait list of 57 households who are waiting to buy a permanently affordable home with Private Ground through Clark County. But we have significant multicultural outreach that we do, and we have all of the people we serve is a list of over 400 families. So we work with partners, and we do the education and counseling that gets them specifically prepared once we market. So I think right now the problem is not really for Progrown, it's marketing the program. We have a very significant following. It's getting the subsidy to really make these homes affordable and continually every year serve more families so that this, you know, 13 homes in Clark County can grow. And the more homes we have in your county, the more resales they will be, so the more families will be served without any subsidy, and that's the end goal.
Now, if someone, because you're looking at low and moderate income
mm-hmm.
level people, but if someone's in one of the homes and improves their financial situation, is there, mm-hmm. they?
There's no additional income documentation after they own their home, so they could go on to improve, yeah.
Any other questions? Right, the 11-minute 51. Almost 12 minutes. Any other questions?
It's got to be a quick one.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And last but not least, we have REACH.
Yeah.
And then it's 5 minutes presentation, 5 minutes questions at the 4 minute mark. All right.
There's a sign. That's good to see.
Yep.
And this is the clicker?
Yep.
Okay.
Some things that I'll be just talking about briefly that are updates, but I realize there's some turnover and folks who haven't seen the project before, so I'll just do some brief overviews as well. We're here talking about Isabella Court Phase 2, project right off of 62nd Avenue and 4th Plain in the city of Vancouver. So we as REACH are the developer here. We'll also be the long-term owner of the property. We're using Housing Development Center to help us with construction management. MWA Architects out of Portland is our architect, and Team Construction here in Vancouver is who we'll be using to be a general contractor. The overall project is 49 units, of which 34 of them are one-bedroom apartments, and now 15 of them are two-bedroom apartments, which is a change from when we presented to you last year when it was 46 one bedrooms and 3 2 bedrooms. And the main reason is that we've now changed population. We were originally going to do another senior project. Phase one was a senior project as well for families at or below 60% of the median income. And now we've really targeted a population of extremely low income and very low income households, many families with children, at or below 50% overall, but over 37 of those 49 units are for folks at 30% of median income and below. In making this population change, we did some slight alterations to the project itself to really accommodate some of the children that will be at the property. But we've also done some energy efficiency upgrades, like triple pane windows, and the prospects for solar water heating and some other things that really help us on the operational side. Here's the site itself. It actually slopes down from our other phase towards Fourth Plain Boulevard, right below us to the south. As you can see, far off are some commercial properties that we abut. The location is pretty much smack dab between I-5 and 205, just north of Fourth Plain Boulevard, but not as far north as SR 500. And this is one of the slides we just wanted to focus on, is what's really happened since we presented to you all last year. We've since then, when we were here again, we have now finished the lease up of Isabella Court Phase 1. This, as a result of Prop 1 and the city's affordable housing fund from coming from the property tax levy, we submitted an application to them in May of last year. We submitted a response to the Vancouver Housing Authority, who had 30 project-based Section 8 vouchers for the project in August. We were awarded those the following month in September, and in the following month in October, we found that we were awarded $850,000 from the city's affordable housing fund from that May application. We submitted a $2.1 million request to the Housing Trust Fund at the Department of Commerce that same month in October, submitted home applications to both you and to the city for the remaining amount of funding we need to move forward. We were excited to hear last month that we were awarded that $2.1 million in mainly home dollars from the Department of Commerce, which is very similar to what happened on phase one, as we had funds from you all, from the city, and from the Department of Commerce that we layered together to make the project work. And then we were also put on the funding allocation list for the 9% housing tax credits when we submitted an application last month. It scored high enough that preliminarily we are at the top of the list for the Metro Pool, which incorporates Clark County, but also Spokane County, Pierce County, the non-King County metro areas throughout the state, and had the second highest score in the state. So we're really excited to really know that the project will have the equity it needs to move forward. What they're currently doing is just going through the scores right now to confirm that everything we said on our self-scoring has the backup documentation with it. We should know in just a few weeks whether that's confirmed or not. And if that's the case, can really move forward with construction at the end of June. All right, let's talk a little bit about the project. We have community gardens, community room, and now a playground, a children's playroom on an upper floor, and some social service offices, because we realized with the population we're going for is going to need some real supportive services, so we'll have space on site to really work with them. Also, a courtyard between the project and really trying to really develop some linkages between the two phases that we'll have there. I kind of went through a little bit where we landed on financing. You can see we have a $13.9 million project. Most of the funds listed under sources are now awarded, but the $406,000 left over is a financing gap, so $250,000 comes from our request to you all, and then we'll be presenting at the city next week for the final $156,000 to really be able to move forward this summer. In terms of need, what we really were seeing was how severely cost-burdened families were in this area. You know, over 1,500 folks that were severely cost-burdened who can't afford, or were paying more than 50% of their housing costs, or out of their income towards housing costs, and that was really just getting untenable. And so we're really addressing a project here that deals with rising rents, their cost burden, some of the partnerships that we've had with the schools who are reporting such a high level of homeless families with children, and feeling like the limited supply we were seeing in the market really needed to be addressed with this project. So our solution really on this phase is to really bring down the rents to a level that's affordable at the $380, $452 a month so that families can really have the dispensable income once they pay rent to really move on with their lives and get the support they need to succeed. And so that population change needed to be addressed in lowering the rents. We're really able to do that with the 30 project-based vouchers that we were awarded last summer from the Vancouver Housing Authority to really make that work. So 37 of those 49 units that we're looking in this project will be targeted for those extremely low-income families, many of them at risk or going through homelessness currently. And the remaining 12 would be for folks at or below 50% of median income, but all the rents would be at 30% rents for the whole project. So I will take any questions you have. I just wanted to add real quick here, you see phase one getting constructed. We already have site control on that lot below. We have the same team moving forward with this project, so there's some real savings in having a mobilized team that's already done this before, adding the same number of units. In terms of schedule, by able to get this home funds towards construction itself, we'll be able to kind of move forward this summer. And the amount of leverage for a $13.9 million project that now has over 13.5 really brings a lot of investment from the state and federal level to this particular project in this community. So we hope for we can go forward with your home funds.
Question. So the Section 8 vouchers, are those permanent for the people? Okay.
They are, and they're project-based, so they stay with these units.
So the people that move into those, are they going to be able to eventually increase their income and still be able to stay there? Like, or do they have to leave after they...
They wouldn't have to leave. There's ways of, both within the tax credit program and the Section 8, that you just adjust the amount that gets paid towards their rent. So we project the project right now thinking that they're at 30% in area median income and what income that would be for that they can contribute to rent. That's a sliding scale if they were to earn more money of how much they'd be paying, and then that housing authority would be picking up the remainder.
Okay, so they went out of the program. I was worried about people and that they make too much.
No one tries to displace, whether in the tax credit program, the home program, no one gets displaced. It's usually just an adjustment of income to really accommodate additional rent that they can afford.
So there's 49 apartments, and of those, 34 one-bedroom, 15 two-bedroom, right? And then you said there's 37 units targeted to homeless families, but then you said there's 30 project-based Section 8 vouchers. So are you saying 30 units are project-based and 37 are homeless, and then how do those two tie together?
Good question.
So
yeah.
Total 49.
So of the 30 project-based vouchers, 19 of them are ones and 11 are twos. So there's a difference of unit mix.
Yep.
And of the 37 designated for people at or below 30, not all of them are one bedrooms. A lot of them obviously are going to have some twos. And so that's included in how many we've allocated from the Housing Authority. Most of the 30 coming from the project-based vouchers are a part of that 37.
Okay.
So we only have 7 units that will be at 30% AMI that won't have project-based vouchers attached to them. So that's why we set all the rents at 30. So whether you have a voucher or not, everybody's basically paying the same amount of rent. Some people have a little bit of help from the Housing Authority for their rent. Everybody else is then still paying the same amount,
right,
whether they're at 30 or even at 50% of area median income. And part of that, because we're really trying to address the cost burden so people aren't having to pay abundantly more than their income can really allow.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
On the project financing slide, it shows a $400,000 gap, and then if our award is $250,000, there'd still be remaining like 150. Can you move forward with that small of a gap and just make it work somehow, or do you have to go after other financing?
I think given where our construction cost estimate, that's really still what we need to be able to afford that construction cost estimate, given how much it's increased in the last year. We'd love to be able to, but I think that's really what we need to put everything into the building that, you know, state prevailing wage, and now we have federal prevailing wage on this project, are going to really require.
Are you asking if Clark County funds what the state of Vancouver is not?
Oh, so the other, so you...
That was my question.
That was, yeah, I thought I addressed that a little bit, but part of the 406, 250 from you, 156 is what we're presenting next week at the City of Vancouver home. I mean, can we be flexible and make it work? It's going to be tight. If it's difficult, given where our construction cost estimate, everything else doesn't have a whole lot of other area to be able to accommodate that kind of cut. We obviously made do before. Phase one was really tight on the financing side. We're trying not to go that route here and have a really substantial contingency. We have a really tough site. We have a pump that is required from being lower than phase one. Also building a street all around the site to really allow for fire, you know, traffic if there were an event. So that's really what we're trying to accommodate here on this particular phase.
And then just for the board's information, so maybe we already know that the Home Investment Partnerships Program requires that we set aside 15% of our award each year to Community Housing Development Organization CHODO funds, which is the only applicant we have for these CHODO funds this year would be this project.
is it open? It opened in November 2016. And so,
oh, what?
Okay. Yeah, so maybe we got that one done too fast, right? Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it has vacancies from time to time, though, and definitely have a wait list, but we work with, we have 10 project-based vouchers from the Vancouver Housing Authority there, so we already have that kind of relationship already open. They have basically extended their wait list for their project-based voucher units all the way up down to this phase, so it's really already open. People are interested.
So do you already have, I assume you have people on the waiting list for this next phase?
Well, not our wait list for the non-project-based voucher units, but they do. The Housing Authority does have a wait list already currently open.
You talked about fire access. Are the buildings sprinkled?
Yeah, absolutely.
They have to.
I think, I don't know if it was the four stories that triggered it or not, but the code did.
I thought it was two, but I'm not sure.
Both will have an elevator, though, and we have accessible units in both. Yeah, I think it was a city requirement to make sure that a fire truck could turn around the entire site if there was an event. Other questions? Thank you guys again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we don't have a whole lot left before we wrap up. I'm going to combine the things that no one's scoring than other because looking through last year's minutes, you know, they're kind of overlapping. So please remember that your application scores are due in Zoom grants by Monday, March 5th. When you're looking through the proposals around rental assistance, TBRA. Like last year, it's helpful if you familiarize yourself with what rapid rehousing is, which is a requirement for county funding of rental assistance programs. The reason we provide you with this information is some proposals sometimes struggle with what Housing First is, what rapid rehousing is. And they're looking for, you know, fair, this is not with judgment or malice, but, you know, they're looking for a source of funds to provide rental assistance, which is worthy, but, you know, everything we fund with these dollars supports the homeless crisis response system in Clark County, which means they have to be people who are experiencing homelessness. It has to go through a coordinated assessment process. It has to go through the Housing Solutions Center for a coordinated entry process. It has to meet rapid rehousing, Housing First requirements. So, you know, so when you look at the proposals, this cheat sheet will help you if there's fidelity to that model or not.
I'm sorry, I'm so freaking annoyed. I'm just
kidding.
I have another question. Just about how you're talking about the rapid rehousing and things. When we give grant somebody funds, is it, I guess it doesn't matter what they do with it, but is there a conflict if they're using the funds to pay for rent at their own buildings, like at their own income?
Whether it's, generally speaking, no.
Okay.
So there are some funding sources that and this is not one of them that say you cannot do that because you know, you cannot be receive funds to provide rental assistance if you are the landlord in any way. And an example of that, I want to say Commerce Hen Funds does that. The home TBRA funds does not do that. Of the proposals you received today, Lifeline would be a potential, not definite, but you know they're trying to acquire some housing that they can use. And Share Aspire has a couple units. Most of the Share Aspire units are out in the market. They're, you know, so I think odds are that any of the TBRA Share Aspire funds would actually not go to share-owned housing, just based on availability of housing. But it is not a conflict by the rules with this fund.
I just noticed that because I'm researching some things on that. I wondered if that was.
Yeah. So with the home TBRA funds, they need to, you know, the primary thing is they need to meet pretty stringent legal lease requirements. So people who are receiving funds that will be used, you know, TBRA funds, they have to have a lease. The lease needs to be for a year, you know, like, and we specify it in, you know, in our contract. You know, they have to have the rights of a renter, you know, and the landlord needs to comply with their obligations of a landlord.
So, sorry, you said a one-year lease. Is that for the property, for the renter?
For the lease itself between the renter and the landlord. And there are circumstances, you know, where, you know, they could be like on a 6 month or month to month, but generally speaking, it's a 1 year, you know, by HUD.
So if I recall, the Salvation Army's app, they mentioned case management services were voluntary, not
yeah.
required. So is that not consistent with component three of the rapid rehousing model? Does it have to be mandatory?
No. It's consistent. Voluntary services are consistent with the model. If you had someone that said they have to receive case man, you know, they have to receive these services to stay in the to stay in their housing, that would not be consistent.
Got it.
Yeah. So if you have any questions in terms of Zoom grant scoring itself, Rebecca Royce is your best resource. She's the most expert in the Zoom grants mechanics themselves. But you know, please give any of us a call if you need it. And we are also, if they're not on already, over the past 2 weeks, we have been going through putting in the staff comments on our history and experience with each of the proposals and proposers. You know, just and been keeping them objective. So.
I thought they came and presented today because reading the applications online.
Yes, it is. Also moving forward, one of the things we're striving for, and I'm going to try to structure more in terms of requirements for presenters, is kind of standardize the presentations between people, you know, the entities making proposals. So anyone that's applying for TBRA, these are the five things we want them to touch on. You know, I'd like facilities proposals to generally look like the one you just got from Reach, you know, that gives you the location, the project description, the financing picture, you know, so you have a better visualization of it and you can compare apples to apples. Okay, last thing, remember bus tour is gonna be Monday, February 22nd, 8 a.m. to 12. Is it Thursday?
Yeah.
Thursday. Did I put? Okay. Sorry. Thursday, February 22nd, 8 to 12 p.m. And that's all I have. Sam, do you have anything else?
Well, breaking news: the 2019 president's budget was released this morning, and he zeroed out CDBG at home again.
What?
He zeroed out CDBG at home.
So that's not a surprise. Do your advocacy as in, yes, Thursday the 22nd. I don't know why I wrote Monday. That's me. That was my bad. And we need a motion to adjourn.
I have a question. Where are we meeting for the, do we meet here?
We meet at Center for Community Health, which is on the VA campus on 4th Plain. And if you need the address, we can send that to you. It's building 17 in the lobby.
Thank you.
Right next to the probably that type of boarding.
Parking is a challenge there.
Actually, it's not too bad if you get there before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you drive the Prius.
And if you don't.
I always park in the
middle
of my
spot.
If you drive home with my husband, he has a Prius. He has a Prius. I have a truck. I don't have the address.
I'll send to you.
I can use my GPS. I can find it.
Sure.
Oh,
so need a motion to adjourn. We need a motion to adjourn.
It's 16:01.
Second.
Meetings adjourned.